America.
Are you ready? We're getting ready to get started. Stand by.
Gentlemen, welcome. This is the Just Cause AJC Radio, where we are in search for justice. And if you haven't noticed, there's one thing that's going on. Lady Justice is missing. Does anyone know where she is? Because I'm going to tell you right now, ladies and gentlemen, what's going on in this country right now lets us know that justice is a long way off. And welcome to the program along with, I'm Lamont Banks along with Charlisa Stewart, Cliff Stewart, welcome back. And Sam is on assignment tonight, and we are glad to have you. And I'll tell you as we do every week, you know, if you got family, you got friends, you got uncles and aunts and cousins and everybody that you can think of, give them a call tonight and tell them to tune in to the program. We are calling you live, or coming to you live, rather, from Colorado Springs, Colorado. Thank you for joining us tonight. Lisa, how are you doing, and how's everything going tonight?
Going pretty good, Lamont.
All right, Cliff?
Yep, doing good. Good to be, you know, back in the studio. You know, it's good to be here.
Okay, and we got some really, really important things that we're going to dig into tonight that we believe that is definitely going on in this country. We're going to be talking along the lines of something very important. But before we get to that, Lisa, can you do our disclaimer, please?
Yes, we want to just remind everyone that we are not attorneys, and A Just Cause does not provide legal advice. You want to contact your personal legal advisor for all of your legal needs. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests do not necessarily reflect that of A Just Cause. As always, thank you for tuning in and choosing to spend some time with us this evening.
Okay, thank you, Lisa, for that. And the topic we're going to be digging into tonight is going to be talking about the protesting movement in this country. And I believe the protest, that stuff goes back many, many years, down to the civil rights movement in this country many years ago. And a protest is alive and well. And what we'd like to dig into a little bit tonight, we're going to actually be talking about what is in the mind of protesters. What is the purpose of a protester? And I'll tell you, it comes down to something very simple, Lisa and Cliff, and that is the fact when a person feels like they need to go protest, something terribly has gone wrong. Because a protest, you are protesting something that has happened or an injustice that has taken place. And we're going to dig into that tonight as we get started. But we're going to go first to current news. And Lisa, was there a couple of articles I know that you had your eye on that we'd like to dig into getting started?
Yeah, we're looking at an article put out on Fox News talking about a judge, a Pennsylvania judge who made up a criminal charge, is not being charged with any crime. It says the federal court recently told a Lawrence County woman she's simply out of luck and can't sue local officials, including a common pleas judge, who apparently made up a criminal charge that was used to place her on electronic monitoring. The judge has absolute civil immunity, even if the action was in error, was done maliciously, or was in excess of his authority. The three-judge panel ruled in its six-page opinion.
Wow.
And, you know, that is what now, you look at that and then you ask a question, why do people take out their frustrations and take the law into their own hand, and why do judges get shot? This is a perfect example of why a person would basically go rogue, go outside of the law, and feel like they need to seek out their own justice, because you have a judge making up a criminal charge, basically putting you – that this is tyranny. That's absolutism, that you say a judge can make up a criminal charge, charge you with it, and then basically put you in jail or put you on electronic monitor for something that's not even the law. And then they wonder, why is there violence against officials of the court? That is a perfect example of, and am I advocating that a person would take the law into their own hands? Absolutely not. But this is a perfect example of, you see the reason why a person would, because you're not getting any relief in the courtroom. This is where Lady Justice has basically, she's nowhere, like you said earlier, nowhere to be found, missing in action, because a judge can make up the rules and then has absolutely immunity. That is insanity.
So there's no action going to be taken against this judge on any level, no censure?
Nope, they say she's out of luck. She is out of luck because he's immune. He's got immunity.
I see. This goes to, again, I think goes to the point that this is the reason why protesters are in the streets. That mindset from a judge is why the fairness of a fair trial. How can you possibly put a judge who holds the decision of defendants in his hand to determine their fate? If a judge, their moral compass is out of whack to the point that you would do something like this, then what else have you done morally and ethically wrong on that bench that goes to our overcrowding and our huge incarceration problem in this country? That's just the bottom line of what it is.
And you know what? They also say in this article that the reason, they say now she was to report to jail after she didn't pay her husband's, her ex-husband's attorney's fees as ordered, even though she was appealing that order. He sentenced her to 90 days in jail and had her arrested on a bench warrant. Then he went in, and she'd never been charged with anything. She hadn't had a trial. She hadn't been convicted of anything. He just went in and put a criminal charge in the system to place her on electronic monitoring.
My question is, how is that not illegal?
It is illegal.
It is illegal, but his absolute civil immunity lays out that even if the action he took was an error, done maliciously, or in excess of his authority. So,
wow,
he can basically say, while I was doing my job, I went up, slapped you, and when you retaliated, I shot you. But I was doing my job, so there's nothing that can happen to me. She almost lost her job, because she had no paperwork for this charge that he made up to say that this is why she was in court. Now, they said that she didn't have a trial. She wasn't convicted. There was no charge. She was just put in jail for 90 days and put on electronic monitor.
This is again, I believe, where Congress, the judicial process, the Judiciary Committee on Capitol Hill has to take action against. We just said this some weeks ago, that judges now doing what they're doing is now setting precedents that you can do. And this is beyond corrupt. And how he's not held accountable by that. What state is that, Lisa?
Pennsylvania.
That is incomprehensible to me, that a judge can do whatever he wants. And you want me to believe that when I go in a courtroom as a defendant, number one, wrongfully accused, I go into a courtroom and put my trust in a man or woman who has no moral balance of any kind, and I'm supposed to trust that the system works. That's the biggest joke in our judicial system right now.
If anybody trusts that the system works, they're an idiot.
And you know what? Here's the thing, Lisa and Cliff. These stories come a dime a dozen. These are the ones we're just pulling off.
Right. This happens to get caught up in the news. The rest of now, what else has this judge done that a reporter just hasn't picked up on?
That's right.
That's the sick part of it, because if he's doing this and knowing that, hey, nothing's going to happen to me, what else has this judge done?
Sure. That's unbelievable. And folks, America, I want to just say this to you tonight as you finish up that roast beef or that cornbread or homemade biscuits on the table tonight. I'll say this to you. You know what? We need to. This is dinner conversation, folks. You know what I mean? We just sit back on our couch and our lazy boys. We get the remote control and think that everything is well in America. I got news for you. America has lost her way. Now, we don't want to get serious about it until it happens to Uncle Bob who lives down the street. Or it happens to if it happens to my mother or to my brother, or to my sister, then we want to get up and cry and say something's wrong. Well, something's been wrong.
For a long time.
And I think that goes back, Lisa and Cliff, to what we've been saying for a very, very long time. It's going to take you folks, all of us together, saying, you know what, we're just not going to sit back and let a judge go put his feet up on in his desk and get away with this type of conduct. It has to be spoken against. It has to be dealt with because, you know what, she's not the only person that probably has fallen victim to this judge. I can guarantee you that.
No. I mean, this judge has to have a pattern. If he can do this and knows that he can get away with it, then his pattern has to there's a trail that
Absolutely.
Comes to this action right here that shows that this judge is totally out of control. Guarantee you dig into his background, and there's stuff like this all up and down in his courtroom. If this reporter for Fox News would go and query the people of Lawrence County in Pennsylvania, guaranteed this judge is well known for pulling crap just like this because he understands that his absolute civil immunity, and see, that's the thing. Now, what the audience has to understand, his civil immunity means you can't sue him. So something in this story is twisted because he still broke the law. The governor actually should come after him, but the people can still come after him. She can't sue him for this civilly to say, okay, you did something, now I'm going to sue you, but the law still can come after him, and that's what people have to understand. This man needs to be brought up on criminal charges.
I mean, this is criminal.
Absolutely.
I mean, you will go to jail for giving a false report to a police officer.
You make up a crime.
But you make up charges. You get this. So basically, you have circumvented the entire due process.
Exactly. This is like somebody sitting in the courtroom, and you'd be like, hey, I didn't tell you to cough. You don't cough in my courtroom. You know what? You're now being charged with whatever, child abuse. And bailiff, arrest him and put him in jail. And I'm going to put an ankle monitor on you. Don't leave your house for the next, not after you get out of jail for 90 days. Be like, well, what are you charging me with? Just shut up and go sit in a cell. That is how stupid this is and how out of control that this judge would do something like this.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, this night, as you tune in to AJC Radio, is going to get more and more interesting this evening. We're going to give you a personal invitation tonight to call in to area code 347-838-8976. That's 347-838-8976. And we ask, you know, I believe everybody has something to say. And I think, you know, we can sit back and talk about what's going on, but we need to hear from you. We need to hear what your thoughts are. What are you thinking? What is your family thinking? As America stands at a crossroad of decision to make these changes and to bring about change and accountability for these judges, for these officials and a lot of these, if I'm not mistaken, Lisa, a lot of judges that sit on the bench today are elected judges.
Yes.
So I got a question for America. Do we elect judges that do these things? We won't hesitate to go out at our presidential election or our congressional elections and say, you know what, I don't think our representative has represented us well. I think we're going to vote for him out and vote somebody else in. Well, you know what? That mindset has to be applied to these judges. I will tell you a story here in Colorado. A gentleman by the name of Tim Masters was wrongfully convicted. He was 17 years old of a murder he never committed. He did 10 years in the state prison, and he exhausted all of his post-conviction relief. They said denied. The appellate court said conviction stands. The Colorado State Supreme Court says conviction stands. Habeas corpus denied. Every post-conviction relief that he sought out was denied. 10 years, he said, in state prison for a crime he did not do. And he said, you know what, I'm going to file a motion, 35C motion, which for our listeners that don't know what that is, it's a motion for ineffective counsel. And he filed that, and he began to send his story out to other folks, attorneys and different people that had influence and said, look, I'm innocent. Something's wrong here with this case. And there was a lady, I saw the report on 48 Hours on CBS, And she did the report, and this little attorney, not really known as a well-known attorney, saw something, and she had ended up calling in a very high-profile attorney who had heard about what was going on, and they were able to go back into court and say, number one, my attorney failed, but when they began to open up the box, if you will, everything that you can think of as far as corruption, as far as stuff that was hidden, as far as stuff that was concealed, evidence that was there that would have exonerated this man who went to prison as a boy. And 10 years later, he got out. Well, he took it upon himself to get petitions signed. And guess what? Those prosecutors that were prosecuting and did what they did, a couple of them happened to get elected to the judgeship. And he went around to the communities and said, you know what? We're going to petition that this judge be removed because of what he did. I got news for you. Some of those judges no longer sit on the bench anymore. So I don't care how long it goes. I don't care how long it takes. Persistence for justice and search for justice is what's going to bring about change. Tim Masters is free tonight. It doesn't take away the 10 years they took from him, the horror that he went through, the shame that he went through, all of those things that he had to endure as a youngster. And as he got older, knowing he was not guilty of those crimes, this is what A Just Cause is all about. And we are about finding justice. And I said it before, I'll say it again, we are in search for justice here. And something has to be done to bring this justice about. So I think, Lisa and Cliff, as we dig into this, it is the most frustrating thing as we report this. Believe me, ladies and gentlemen out there in America, if you are frustrated, we are equally as outraged at this type of behavior. It just does not make any sense. So we're going to do our very, very best to inform you tonight. And we ask you again to feel free to call into the program and say, look, you know, I got something I want to say. You know, I don't believe in this. It takes people coming together and making these changes. So I think as we get ready to get going and dig into this, I think we're going to learn a heck of a lot about what's going on in this country right now. And you know what? We can keep turning a blind eye and acting like that, you know, nothing's going on. It's just not that bad. Until we take a look at it and look in the mirror as Americans and look at our judicial system is what it is, we're never ever going to change that. So I think we need to pay attention to that. So coming up, folks, we're going to probably dig in a couple of more current events as we get back, but we are getting ready shortly. Our guest tonight that's joining us on the program is Catherine Broderick, and she is going to be chiming in. She has had, it looks like, some involvement in the Baltimore protests that have happened out there. A very, very classy lady. And I tell you what, ladies and gentlemen, if you're tired tonight, grab a cup of coffee, cup of tea.
Red Bull.
Maybe a Red Bull. We're going to get started, ladies and gentlemen. Call everybody around the kitchen table and say, hey, let's get ready to learn something tonight. This is the Just Cause, and we are in search for justice. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
I can solve difficult problems for a Fortune 500 company.
I can run a successful business.
I can manage your home improvements.
I can publicize your message.
I can motivate your audience.
I can put my military experience to work for your company.
I can teach your children.
I can boost your bottom line.
I can add value to your workplace.
I could be a loyal and productive employee.
But I can't put my skills to work for your organization
if I'm not given the opportunity.
If you don't recognize my talents and ability.
If you don't hire me.
If you don't have an open mind and a workplace that's open to everyone.
If you don't realize that America works best when everybody works.
What can you do?
What can you do?
What can you do?
You can remember that it works.
It's what people can do.
It's what people can do that matters.
Nearly 50 million Americans have disabilities. Capitalize on their talents with employment practices that benefit everyone. Learn more at whatcanyoudocampaign.org.
Odds of becoming an astronaut, 1 in 13,200,000. Odds of being struck by lightning, 1 in 576,000. Odds of dating a supermodel, 1 in 88,000. Odds of bowling a perfect game, 1 in 11,500. Odds of being trapped in an elevator, 1 in 24,528. Odds of catching a ball at a major league game, 1 in 563. Odds of an injury from shaving, 1 in 6,585. Odds of tripping while texting, 1 in 10. Odds of getting cancer in your lifetime, 1 in 2 men, 1 in 3 women.
It's up to us
to change the odds for our generation.
For the ones we love.
For our future.
If you don't like the odds, stand up. Stand up to cancer.
If you were convicted of a crime you did not commit, what would you do? How would you feel to have your basic human rights stripped from you in a matter of seconds?
Each day, thousands of crimes are committed, and each day, thousands of people nationwide are convicted of crimes they did not commit.
Eyewitness misidentification is the number one factor that causes most wrongful convictions. This is due to the mind filling in blanks with things that seem right, or things that they hear from others, such as the police, media, and other witnesses. If you are unsure if the person that stands before you committed the crime, do not put an innocent person in jail. Don't convict the innocent.
Talk, news, politics, and inspiration.
The opinions and views expressed by guests and callers on A Just Cause Coast to Coast do not necessarily reflect those of A Just Cause or A Just Cause Coast to Coast.
Ladies and gentlemen of America, if you notice that sound, that is the sound of war. And make no mistake about it, this country is at war right now. And we are in search for justice. Lady Justice has gone missing. Our aim to find her. I'm Lamont Banks along with Charlisa Stewart, Cliff Stewart. And this is AJC Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for joining us tonight as we dig into topics and information that is thought-provoking and hopefully to the point of bringing about change. And we're glad to be here. And as we were talking at the beginning of this program in regards to right now, at least on the current events, and but the topic we will be going into here shortly, we'll be addressing the protesters. What's the history of protest in this country? Where did it come from? How did it get started? We're going to answer some of those questions, but most importantly tonight is why are protesters behaving sometimes in the way that many don't understand? Lisa Cliff, I have, you know, it doesn't take much to turn on CNN and have everybody criticizing every protest that goes on in this country. And we are aware there are peaceful protests and there are protests that are a little bit less peaceful. But the big question tonight is, America, is what we got to look at is why are the protests becoming somewhat violent at times? What is motivating people to protest and lose control at times because a system that has failed? There comes a point of, you know, I said this last week on the program, if you keep, you know, you got a little dog, he's a real friendly fella at the front door, his name may be Duke or Buck or whoever, but he's at the front door, and you know, as long as you're feeding him and he's coming through there eating a little dog food and getting a little water and some the French benefits of sitting around the kitchen table while the family's eating, he's good to go. But I guarantee you, that little dog, if you keep kicking him, every day, every minute you walk by, you just kick him in the ribs and keep going. You know, he comes back, you kick him in the ribs again, he keeps going. There's going to come a moment, that little dog's going to show you teeth you didn't know he had. You know, he's tired of being kicked.
That's right.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are getting kicked here in America, but it's a lot, and make no mistake about it, it's a lot more serious than a kick. People are dying as a result of this thing. And so if a dog, in the moment of being kicked a few times, or his dog food tray being empty sometimes when he's gone there to eat, will motivate him to be pushed to a point that's not normal, well, I tell you right now, ladies and gentlemen, we are being pushed beyond normal right now as a country, as a society, and as a people. You know, we got a lot of our people dying. That makes it a heck of a lot more serious as we dig into this tonight. So, you know, let's be careful as we sit and Oh, no, how could they do that in that town? Do you live there? Were you a victim of police brutality there? Was it your son? Was it your daughter? It took a bullet, eight warning shots in the back.
That's not funny.
I mean, come on here.
And you know what?
Yeah.
Martin Luther King made a statement about protests, even back in the day, that he said that basically riots are the voice of the unheard.
Exactly.
So
wow.
If you continue to treat us like we're not a people, you continue to treat our issues like they don't matter, like we're not heard, you gun us down in the street like rabid animals, then at some point we are going to have to make a voice that does not just come out of our mouth. It's going to have to be action. So that is what a riot is. That is what a protest is. You have not heard me when I spoke to you. When I went to the courthouse and said, hey, I didn't do it, and like this crazy judge in Pennsylvania, you make up a charge and put me in jail, then at some point you say that we as a people have to mount up and say, you know what, our voice is not being heard. We need to scream a little louder.
Absolutely.
We need to do it in not words, but we need to do it in actions. That's what a protest is. That's what a march is. And I'm not condoning burning down your city. I mean, you should not burn down your own city. That's where you live. Don't torch your house. If you go to war, you don't torch your ships. You torch the enemy ships.
Absolutely.
But that is what a protest is, and that is why it is an integral part of what America is. Because if a group of people are not getting their point across, there's one thing to do. Go to your elected officials and say, hey, we will raise a ruckus, show you signs and actions that say we do not approve with the way that we as a people are being treated. That's why it's a government by the people and for the people, because the people ensure that the laws are enforced.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, let me give you something real quick, what the definition of protest is. It says, number one, it's a verb. I think we talked on this program a couple of weeks ago. What, are you a noun or are you a verb? A noun's just at the beginning of a sentence here. He don't have the ability to move, but a verb is action. Listen to what this says. To express a strong objection to something, to participate in a public demonstration in opposition to something, to promise or affirm earnestly as after being doubted, a formal declaration of disapproval or objection issued by a concerned person, group, or organization. Think of that. So when you, Lisa and Cliff, when you make the statement here tonight, a strong objection. He says a formal, the reason it's done publicly, because it is to say not only to you and your family, but to this city, to this community, to this country, we are outraged. That is the purpose of protesting. That is why it is so very, very important. So I think when you begin to understand that, you know, there's been, what did the folks in Ferguson protest? What was their objection?
Yeah, they're protesting against the way they've been treated. They've been being kicked by the police in that city for years and years and years, and they finally got to the point where they said, we're not taking this anymore. We're tired of it.
And you know what's funny to me, you'll see, not funny, but what's amazing to me, when you turn on any of the news networks and you'll have the analysts on there, well, what do you think's going on down here, Dave, down there in Ferguson? The response you get from those folks is, well, you know what? I don't think they should continue that protesting like they're doing. They need to calm it down a little bit. That's until it's you. Calm it down. I object. I object to Michael Brown being shot to death by an officer when he was unarmed. We object to Walter Scott being stopped for a taillight that was out, supposedly. It was daytime. The sun was out, so you couldn't see the taillight. That's another story in another show. We object to Eric Brown being choked to death when he's telling officers. I don't know how many officers were out there. A group of officers surrounding this man. He has his hands up saying, hey, man, I didn't do anything. We object, America. Do you object? We object, Your Honor. We object, Mr. President. We object, Mr. Attorney General. This is what protesting is. And until we get that embedded in our being of who we are, and you have to ask yourself the question, Lisa, and I think the question goes out to folks that sit back and say nothing. You know, Mr. Sharpton, where are you at? We don't hear no objection from you. Our civil rights leaders, where's your objection? It's equally Sinclair as if you're sitting in a courtroom, the prosecution does something so deliberate and outrageous, and your attorney sits there and does nothing. That's how outrageous it is.
Yeah.
So, folks, that's something to think about. We're going to dig into this even further. We are honored tonight, as we shift gears but stay in the same place, to have Catherine Broderick, a classy lady out here making a difference and standing up. She is actually in the Baltimore, Maryland area, I guess has had some opinions, if you will, and some actions regarding the Baltimore protests that were going on down there. And we're gonna actually bring her on. And Catherine, I'm going to let you tell your story. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes out of your schedule. We are honored to have you on AJC Radio tonight. Welcome.
Well, thank you so much. And please call me Shelley. Technically, my real name is Catherine, but I go by Shelley all my life.
Okay.
And it's a nickname for my middle name. My parents thought that I should get to explain that all day, every day.
No, but no worries with that. Shelley, as we go forward here, understand that you was appointed Dean of the University of the District of Columbia, David Clark School of Law, in August of 1999. And you served as an interim dean, it looks like here, clinical director, associate dean, and faculty member since 1979.
Kind of a lifer.
You have a resume there, don't you?
Yes, I do.
Catherine, why don't you tell our listeners tonight, I'm going to give you the floor and let you tell our listeners and what you do, and we're going to get in that dialogue about, as we've been talking about protesting and the power of protesting, but the importance of it, and that those rights definitely not be taken from us. But I think there's a different angle that we're looking at on protesters, and we're going to sit back and have you inform us and our listeners tonight, and the floor is yours.
Well, you're very kind, and thank you for the work that you're doing to shine a light on what's going on, because what's going on, you know, to quote Chris Rock, it ain't right. So I'm the dean of a very special law school. It's a law school dedicated to recruiting and enrolling students from racial, ethnic, and other backgrounds traditionally underrepresented at the bar. So we're ranked second in the nation for most diverse student body. We're between 50 and 60% students of color and over half women. And we're diverse in every way from socioeconomic background, race, ethnicity, gender, and political point of view. We had a president of the class who was a Republican, which at an HBCU just doesn't happen all day, every day. And the second part of our mission is to represent the legal needs of low-income D.C. residents to the maximum extent feasible through the legal clinic. So I was hired by the legendary Gene Campercon, a firebrand from Baltimore, whose father started the NAACP in Baltimore. Gene married a white man, and wasn't enough for her to be a black woman married to a white man. She converted to Judaism, went to law school, and had two sons in law school, and just never stopped protesting and making herself heard. She and her husband founded the law school. So this law school, you know, our students begin by writing an essay in their application about an instance of injustice that they witnessed or experienced. Okay? That's how it starts. And they come into class 2 weeks before regular classes begin to a course called Law and Justice, taught by Edgar Kahn, Gene Campercon's husband. And they talk about the injustices that they experienced and they witnessed and what did they do about it. And they talk about immigration policy and the school-to-prison pipeline and whatever it is, social justice issues. Because we want them to know when they start law school, there's an end game. So every student does 40 hours of community service in the first year. They do 350 hours in poverty clinics in the second year and again in the third year. They do practicums around immigration and veterans' rights and so on, where they go work. They do service learning. They're down in the Mississippi Delta and at the Arizona-Mexico border, helping people in deep poverty. It's a pervasive curriculum around social justice. So I know I'm going on and on, but I wanted to set the scene when it happened that Freddie Gray was killed, mm-hmm. and my students, many of whom are from Baltimore and the metropolitan Baltimore area and all the way to D.C., they were watching their city burn. And yeah. I don't think anybody anticipated, you couldn't even hope for the charges that were brought against the police to be brought. And so people thought it was going to escalate and get worse and worse and worse. And it was very bad. Something like 250 businesses were destroyed. And, you know, if people were in the street making themselves heard. And I had a student ask me, can I defer my exams? I need to go to work. And I said, I can't defer all your exams. That's a faculty matter. But then I got an email from a student, and the email said her son had graduated from Coppin Academy. And it's a matter of blocks from where everything was happening. And she knew that as things escalated, the kids like her son were going to be in the streets and they were at risk. And she mm-hmm. couldn't come to school to take an exam. Life was happening. It was too important. And she needed to be part of the movement. And then another and another and another and another student spoke up and said, hey, we need to be part of this. And so my incredible team, Jonathan Smith, who just came to us a few weeks ago from the Department of Justice, where he oversaw the writing of the Ferguson reports, and Lori Morin, who's a social justice lawyer, all of her career doing community development work, and Anna Maria Stewart, who's probably going to be the next president of D.C. Bar, got the bar to apologize to African-American lawyers who weren't allowed in the bar until the 50s. You know, it's an activist group. And they put together a very measured response, and it was a no-brainer. Yes, I said, you can defer an exam if you work with legal observers, if you hook up with an organization doing legal research, if you're doing teach-ins and you let us know in advance, and you can put one exam off until May 11th. So it's a measured response, but we feel you, we get you, you're the vanguard of the next generation of social justice movements. And police community relations are the single most important civil rights issue of the day. And we have to embrace their mission.
No, absolutely, Shelley. And as I'm hearing you, it's amazing to me, and I think that is what you need to instill in lawyers that are coming out of law school. The fact that they're doing here community service, they're seeing other people in other walks of life. Those are critical things. We're going to get into that as we go forward. We have someone I think you may know. Tamara Brown is joining us now. And
she is fabulous. Now you'll see why I'm inspired every day.
Okay, and Tamara says that she is currently entering her third year of law school at the University of Columbia. And Tamara, we salute you and what you're doing. From what I'm hearing from Shelley tonight and our listeners, man, you guys are doing some good stuff down there. I'm going to let you have the floor for a few minutes and tell us what's happening down there. Talk to us.
Well, hi, how are you? Thanks, and it's a pleasure being here on the radio with you this evening. And I thank Dean Broderick for having me here with her. So basically, yes, my son, I'm an older law student, and I have a son that graduated from a Baltimore City public school. So when this happened, I was actually studying for my final exams, and I received a text from my son, which I didn't see. You know, it was hours later after, regarding what the students were planning on doing. He was still receiving text messages, even though he's away in college in another state. He was still receiving text messages from his friends here in Baltimore City. So he was warning me not to go to the mall. Some things were going to happen. And, I heard the helicopters. I heard a lot of things happening. I knew the students were getting involved in some things. So as a parent and as a citizen of Baltimore City, I've been a trained legal observer with the National Lawyers Guild for about a year now. When everything happened in Ferguson, a couple students and I went and got training in Washington, D.C. So, I just tried to figure out a way that I could help. And I tried to get down to the juvenile booking center just to observe to make sure nothing additional happened to any of the minors being arrested. I was not successful at that. The traffic was extremely backed up. So it was just, when I saw everything happening in Ferguson, you think to yourself, this could never happen in my city. And when you see it happen in your city and it's happening all around you and the mall is less than a half mile away from my house, it takes over. I mean, it totally took me over. I was on an emotional roller coaster. And I got a lot of calls and text messages from my classmates that couldn't be there because they didn't live in the vicinity. They were in D.C. and were preparing for their exams. And I was just really honored and grateful that Dean Broderick did defer those exams for us to participate. I mean, we really got some hands-on experience working with the students at Coppin Academy. The following Friday, we did do a sit-in and teaching the students of their legal rights and engaging with the police. I mean, the students are leaving their school, and the National Guard and the police are directly across the street. It was a huge presence there. So we thought it was important to teach the students how to engage in those circumstances, and we wanted to hear how they felt about what was going on. And they were pretty upset about the reputation they were getting, and, they just wanted someone to listen. So we were able to pull together a nice team, including the NAACP president of the Baltimore City chapter, and she joined us. And, we just gave the students a chance to talk and learn, and it was a wonderful experience.
Well, as I'm listening to you talk tonight, and I'm, believe me, folks, Shelley and Tamara, this is, to me, is fascinating. This is the type of thing that we need to instill in those young people that are coming up. The firsthand, it's kind of like putting your bootstraps on and getting down there in the mud a little bit. And experiencing these things are so critically important. Let me ask you a question, and we're going to ask both of you this question, and we'll get into it more on the other side of the break because we're going to take one of those here momentarily. But a quick question. As you have observed what you've observed in Baltimore, how important is the protesting movement that be a part of what America does? Shelley, you can go
first. You're talking to the past president of the ACLU in D.C., so I am a huge believer in freedom of speech and the need to speak your mind when things aren't right.
Sure.
And so I think it's critically important because I think the world is listening, and I think it started around Trayvon Martin. I think it started with Tulia, it started. People are finally realizing with Ferguson the progress we thought we made. When you listen to police officers making horrible racist comments, you think, really? Is this the 50s or the 40s or the 30s?
Right.
Really? Can this really still be going on? And you know when they're talking like that, they're acting like that. And
well,
so, people have to protest, but then people need to be legal observers. And the point about that is, you know what happens when somebody's watching you? You behave better. And so you've got a law student wearing a T-shirt that says legal observer, and the police behave better. And so do the kids. So do the folks in the street. They behave. They speak their mind, but they make sure that they stay within the bounds because the police don't want to get caught out again after all the police have been shown to be up to. And the kids know they're being watched too. And so, a peaceful assembly, that's part of the United States dream. Can't do that everywhere.
Well, Shelley, Tamara, can you stay with us on the other side of this break? Because I can guarantee you, is that going to work for you?
Yeah, sure, definitely.
Okay, this is getting ready to get entertaining, folks. Ladies and gentlemen of America, we're just getting started here. And we are honored to have Shelley Broderick and Tamara Brown. I'm telling you, they're giving us some information tonight that you need to pay attention to. Call the neighbors. Call everybody. Tell them AJC Radio is on the line. Stay with us. This is AJC Radio, and we are in search for justice. We'll be right back. We'll be right back.
children are literally eating themselves to death.
Many experts predict that this may be the first generation of children that doesn't live as long as their parents because of the problem of obesity.
A quarter of American children don't exercise regularly. The average school-age child watches 4 to 6 hours of TV every day, bombarded by commercials for fast food and junk.
How you make these kinds of lifestyle changes in your kids is to make them yourself.
Make the effort. Fight childhood obesity. A message from the Government of Canada.
A BART police officer who shot and killed a man.
When I first saw the Oscar Grant footage, like a lot of people here in Oakland, I was outraged.
As soon as I heard about it and I went online and I seen what had happened, tears came down my eyes.
It was something that was very alarming as a police officer and as a citizen of Oakland.
It was like such a blatant murder.
You have a city in trauma. Anyone that's seen that and looks at it is in trauma.
My hope is that people will express their concern with police brutality, but they will do so in constructive ways that don't include violence.
We cannot perpetrate this cycle of harm and violence in this community.
Because we do have to live here and they terrorize the city and it's only going to make it worse for us.
They killed our young black brothers.
You can protest, you can try to make a change, but there is a positive way you can do it.
And make sure we let the police know and that we're aware that stuff ain't right out here and we're trying to fix it.
In a way that is about using your voice for justice.
And making Oakland a safer place for everyone to live and get along as one.
Violence is not justice.
Violence is not justice.
Violence is not justice.
Violence is not justice.
Join A Just Cause in the fight against wrongful convictions, judicial injustice, misconduct, and corruption. Contact us at 855-529-4252 or at www.a-justcause.com.
Not only does texting while driving significantly reduce your reaction time, but you are also 10% more likely to leave your lane. This commercial was 30 seconds. That's all it takes to avoid a senseless tragedy.
You are listening to AJC Radio.
Welcome back, America. This is AJC Radio, and we are in search for justice. I'm Lamont Banks and Seth Stewart and Charlisa Stewart. We are digging into something that needs to be addressed in America, not yesterday, not next week, but right now. And joining us tonight, we are honored to have Shelley Broderick and Tamara Brown. And I tell you, they've given us some information tonight that will cause you to do nothing else at a minimum to think and think about what's going on in this country and the need for change. And we are talking about protesting, the purpose of the protest, the purpose of Americans speaking their minds and going to the definition that we read earlier on protest. It means to participate in a public demonstration in opposition to something. And that something tonight is injustice. And we are going to dig further into that. Shelley and Tamara, thanks for being with us and coming back. As we get into that, we asked the question prior to break in regards to what is, how important is protesting? And Shelley gave a profound answer that it is the core, it is the fabric of this country, that the rights of citizens. And if you think about it, when I sit here and think about the protests that happened during the civil rights movement, we are still talking about that today. You can flip on your TV and see protesters in the street today from that many years ago. So it gives you a little bit of an indication of the power and the impact that protesting brings. So, Tamara, I'll give you the opportunity to give your thoughts on that question.
Okay, thank you. for me, you know, protesting, for me in particular, with this particular topic and police brutality, I was profiled. And that's what my essay for law school was about. It was about being profiled by the police when I lived in Virginia. So it really came full circle for me. And, you know, when you're being profiled or when you're being arrested or when something is happening to you, you feel like you don't have a voice. You can't say anything. You're in fear. So for me, my protest, I was protesting initially before any of the riots or anything occurred. I was protesting for my son. I was protesting for myself. I was protesting for my neighbors. And you know, my husband is an attorney here in Baltimore City. I hear what people go through. You know, there have been cases that we've tried where there's been police brutality, and it's really hard to prove when you don't have that videotape, you know, and when you hear the stories, you know, it just is a fundamental right. And for me, when we were out there protesting the Saturday after Mr. Gray passed, to see gang members marching together, so in peace. And it was extremely peaceful. That it's unity. Our community came together in a way that I didn't think was possible. It was very diverse, and so it's just it was the city was speaking, and every city in America, a lot of cities, there was so much protesting going on. So it is absolutely a fundamental right. It was a moment of pure unity for me, and it's a voice. It's the way, you know, you speak about things that you may have experienced in the past, and so that was just an opportunity for me to do so. And that's my personal experience with protesting.
Oh, absolutely.
And I think it's what I'm hearing here is very important from several perspectives. One, the fact that you guys are ensuring that the laws and the rights of every citizen are understood by those citizens, but more importantly, exercised. I mean, when we watched the Baltimore riots and the things that, you know, the news was saying, the things that some of the officials were saying, like, you know, these gang members said they're going to burn things down. Then you saw, you know, the Bloods and the Crips. They came together and said, you know what, we have a statement from us. We know that we have a right to speak to what has been said about, sure, we're gang members, this is the way of life that we chose, this is one of the outlets that we've chosen that, you know, gets our points across as personal individuals. But together, they came together and made a statement on national television that we are not here to destroy our city. The elected officials that are telling the mass public that this is what we're about, we have called a truce amongst one another to come together in this time and in this protest. So you look at the power of protest to not only get the message across of, you know, of the immediate family in the immediate city, but then you see that it brought to, I mean, when you're talking about rival gangs, you're talking about everything that is pretty much a stereotype of what the media shows us in gang, what law enforcement say that gangs are about. You know, they're about death, they're about crime, they may be about, you know, selling drugs or whatever. That is the typical what we see on television. But for them to come together and say, hey, we're here in our gang attire and we have called a truce amongst each other and said that we will exercise our right to riot, but in a fashion that the basically is not being portrayed to the American people. I thought that was amazing to see that they came together not only to say we call a truce to riot together, but we will make a statement together to the masses that says we are not here about committing crime. We're here about getting the point across of the rights that we have. And I wanted to ask the two of you, as far as when law enforcement, you know, Shelly, you said that some of the law students come out there and they have on T-shirts that say, hey, you know, law student as an observer or whatever it is. How does that compare to having a video camera in front of law enforcement? Because a lot of times we see law enforcement, they say, yeah, here's a video. But what they tell us is that 5 seconds before the video, my life was in danger. This person attacked me. That's why I shot him in the back while he was running from us. With law students there, basically wearing their quote-unquote protest attire, saying, I am a law student. I'm here to observe and to report on the acts of law enforcement as a legal professional. So basically, they don't have any wiggle room to say, you know, 5 seconds before that, I felt like I was in danger. What is your take on law students versus a camera being there at a protest or at a situation where law enforcement basically is, where you're trying to basically stave their activity down?
Well, the magic combination, of course, is both, right? So as I said, I'm a past president of the ACLU. I've been a part of it since I was arrested and strip searched for traffic tickets as a first-year law student back in the day. Strip search for parking tickets? Really? How come you got to do that? Twice? And locked up in the Women's Detention Center. I was a law student at Georgetown. You know, what kind of craziness is that? So I got involved with the ACLU because they took my case and ended the practice of strip searching for parking tickets, okay? And the ACLU, you know, we started the Citizen Complaint Bureau in D.C. so that citizens could come forward and talk about police misconduct primarily. And we never got anywhere because it was his word against his. You know, it was a police against a citizen. People want to believe the police, or they say they believe the police, and nothing happens. The camera has changed everything. And
right.
So the ideal combination is the law student with the T-shirt. So that tells the police, I know my rights, and I'm watching. And see this camera? This camera's watching, too. And so I've got my voice, and I will be speaking about what I've seen, whether you take the camera from me and throw it on the ground and smash it or not. You know, this word will get out. So I love it. I just think it's critical. And, you know, the other thing, I just wanted to get to Tamara's point. You know, telling the kids, as she did and my fabulous students did, that, you know, stay calm. Don't run. When you run, bad things happen, like happened to Freddie Gray. Don't run, you know. Young black men run for reasons other than guilt. We know that. They run from fear, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But telling them, don't run, stay calm, and repeat these magic words. These are the words that stop the action. I do not consent to the search. So when kids know those things, but they also know that if you're on probation, you don't have to consent to the search. They can search you. So don't put yourself in a place where you get searched. They can search you, your home, and your car. So having these kids know their rights and think about how to act in a demonstration so that they lessen the chances of putting themselves at risk is so important. The other thing I wanted to say is, you know, how the press covers this. Fox News did a whole piece on me saying reward for rioting. The reward for rioting is I let people defer their exams. You know, I was not promoting rioting. I was promoting helping people exercise their First Amendment right to free speech and their right to assemble. And that's what our students did. And I'm so proud of them, I can't stand it.
Right, and I remember seeing that piece when they wrote about you, saying that you were rewarding, that you were basically rewarding. And the way that they made the protest sound was that the entire protest was a riot, that everything was about bad stuff happening. And I thought, you know, when I read the headline, I'm like, reward, you know. and then when I read the story, I'm like, How do you guys put this out here and not get, how do you as the media not get just, you know, blasted for false reporting? It's like you put a headline and then the story is totally different. That
exactly.
here is a law professor that said, I will defer your, you know, basically your exam if you go out and help people to understand their rights. If you go out and ensure that the police are taking the proper route and that the kids are protesting properly, that they're not committing crime, that they know they're right, that they're staying calm, how do you then make a headline that says that you did anything wrong? I thought it was a total irresponsible. It was definitely irresponsible when I read it, but I chuckled when I read the article. I'm like, you know, and I'm not only, well, I'm bashing Fox News, but not only them. they're on the list of a lot of media outlets. But I'm like, how do you guys do this and absolutely get away with it? But then to think that the public doesn't see what you're doing. I mean, it's one thing to put a spin on a story, but I mean, come on, that's just totally false reporting. It's totally ridiculous, but it did get my attention and get me the
result. I couldn't agree with you more.
And I totally commended you and what you did. I was like, oh, this is beautiful that the kids are understanding what their rights are, and she's helping the law students to not only help their community and to help their community understand their rights and to exercise those rights, but she's also giving them a deference on their exams to do it.
Absolutely. You would not believe I walked in yesterday morning. I opened up two pieces of mail. The first one was from an alum from the 70s who said, you know, I listen, I pay attention, I read the stuff that comes, but this time I'm moved to write you a check because I'm so proud of the students and so grateful that this law school has retained its social justice mission. Second letter I opened up called me a filthy, bottom-dwelling slime, and you should be indicted, convicted of treason, and jailed, you stupid fool.
So they only read the hit.
And I didn't get any extra credit, just to say.
but you know what, Shelley and Tamara, what I think is so impressive here to me is the reason those students reacted the way that they did is because of the foundation that has been laid at your university, at your college, at your law school. That's something that, see, I believe a protest starts, I believe we protest wrong every day. Whether it's a major event or whether it is something in your own personal life that you are dealing with injustice on any level, this is a lifestyle and an action of behavior. This is not something that is, when it's isolated to an incident, that's why you have our civil rights leaders that you're looking for where they are. Where are all the folks that say they are about civil rights? Where are these people? Because I believe from just, Shelley, reading your bio here and what you've done and what you've been through and what you've endured, down to the fact of being strip searched for a parking ticket, I believe it puts in a person a will to fight against that which is wrong when things are done to them personally that are wrong. So I'm very, very much impressed with, and that's my thought. I believe it starts in the heart of every individual and every American that we have to become fed up with what is going on in this country. And whether I can be at home watching something on the news and I begin a protest right in my living room because I protest, I object to that. And so it's not something that's going to be difficult for me to do if I have to go on the street, because you know what, this is what I believe. That's what protesting is. It's what I believe, what my standing is. And I think what you folks have done and are doing is just absolutely fascinating. I will ask you a question. As we look back in time, we say all the time that, I've had people say to me, I was on a flight a couple of months ago, and a lady said to me, I don't know whether when I turn on the news, whether it's the 1960s or it's 2015. She said, I don't know the difference anymore. I'd like to ask that question to both of you. For what you know, or what you have learned, or what you have seen, how different or how related are the signs of the times right now? Are we in reversal as a country based upon what we're seeing in this country today?
Tamara, I want to hear your thoughts about that. 'Cause I'm a big mouth. I'll keep talking.
I don't know if it's a reversal. I just don't think that the racism has ever gone away. I think there's just different venues to voice that racism, and I think we're catching things a little more, whether it's, you know, on camera, you can watch videos of someone ranting, racist slurs, and we didn't have that technology before. So I don't think it's a reversal per se. I think it's always been there. You know, I've experienced it personally. When I speak of it, people don't quite understand it of my own experiences. So I just, I really don't know what to say. It's difficult to raise a child, I believe, in the 60s as it is today. I just don't think anything has changed. I think people, you know, are maybe not as open, but it's still there. I don't think it ever went away. I think racism has always been there. And, I honestly don't know what can be done about it.
You know, go ahead.
And Lisa, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to ask Tamara, have you talked to your son? I know he's in college right now. How have you explained the way things are going to him to make him understand the way the system is? The younger they are, the less they understand, because they weren't around when things were as bad as they were. I mean, things are still bad, but how do you handle that with him, explaining to him that with all the riots and the things that are going on, how do you deal with that with him?
Well, again, Lisa, he introduced me to what was going on. He's you know, the social networks were buzzing amongst the children, and he knew what was going on. He was rather shocked. At one point, he even said, you know, I don't know if I want to come home for summer. You know, it's a little crazy in Baltimore, but, you know, he's here, he's home, and he wants to go back and speak to some of his peers, you know, at the high school. You know, I've learned from my son, and I think it's not just, and what the children demonstrated to us is it's not a one-way, we're not always teaching them, sometimes they're teaching us. So I have learned a lot, and my son is extremely resilient. I could tell you stories of having him in private schools where he was the only African-American boy, and he was singled out a lot, you know, and I thought that was helping him when it was actually harming him. So, he's experienced a lot, and you would be really surprised at what kids know, what children know, and what they, what I've learned just from raising him. And it was quite astonishing, and, you know, he had some pretty bad experiences himself. So, this isn't new to him. I think he understands why the students did what they did, not that he agrees with it per se, but I just think, again, you know, it's the voice of the unheard. Like, people just feel so unheard. You hear your cousins, your family members, police brutality, you've experienced it yourself. You know, when we were out at one of the protests, one of my husband's ex-clients came up to him and said, you know, Mr. Brown, do you remember when the police knocked my teeth out? You know, I had to be here. So it's stories like that, you know, maybe we don't hear amongst our family members. And so, my son just, you know, he's taught me a lot. I can say I'm actually learning from him, and I'm trying to learn from the younger generation instead of always trying to instill what I think. I think it's time that we just start listening to them.
Yeah. Okay. Boy, that's so true. You know, my daughter, I have a 23-year-old who's in college in the University of Colorado in Denver. But she went to a big, huge D.C. public high school. And I remember driving her to a school event early one morning, and they started, the kids were all in the car, and the tech started blowing up, and two of the kids in her class had been shot in drive-bys the night before. And the graduation, which was full of hip-hop and incredible speeches and poems, led off with the posthumous conferral of high school degrees on the moms for these kids. And I used to tell my daughter, you know, you dye your hair purple, and you're riding in a car with your friends who are every race and ethnicity and flavor you can think of, and you can't even tell what anybody is anymore.
Right.
You know, you really, that kid looks white. I know, Dad. That kid's not. This kid looks black. You know. But in any event, you got your purple hair. You get pulled over. It's like putting a sign to your head saying, "Out there." Something's going on, experimenting, trying things, right? I'm an old criminal defense lawyer for many, many years. I represented tons of protesters and tons of people charged with crimes. You know, don't draw attention to yourself if you're going to be in a car where somebody might be carrying something that can get everybody in the car locked up. And you don't want to get locked up, because anything can happen after that, right?
Well, absolutely. So, I'm sorry, Sally. Go ahead.
No. I mean, you know, I'm just saying these kids have a range of experiences. that we didn't all have. You know, my brother was very badly wounded in Vietnam, and I was demonstrating and protesting forever against the war. One of the points I want to make is a lot of this hate mail that I've gotten has indicated that I hate police or I'm anti-police, and there's nothing further than the truth. Something's going down. I want a cop to come protect and defend me, you know, and I think we all do. I'm protesting, and I'm against police brutality. What I'm for is police accountability. And that's what I love about our students. They're making sure that there's police accountability and citizen accountability. You know, it's a two-way street. That's what I appreciate, that focus. You know, I wasn't anti-military because I was anti-war. I adore my brother.
Well, Shelley, I'd say this. How much more time do you and Tamara have? We don't want to impose on any engagements that you folks may have. How much time do you folks have?
I'm home. It's 9 o'clock. I'm fine.
Yeah, if you would like to continue the discussion, I can make myself available. No problem.
What we'll do is we're going to come back on the other side of the break. And I can tell you right now that this is something that is, I believe, the American people need to know. That this is something, and I like, Shelley, what you said. It's about people working together and coming together, and it's a two-way street. I got to trust the police officer. In return, the police officer must trust me.
Exactly.
Must give me the benefit of the doubt. And I think that is critically important. So stay with us, Shelley and Tamara. We're going to be coming back here momentarily. And we appreciate what you've given to this program tonight, and we're coming right back. Ladies and gentlemen of around this country, whether you're in Texas, New York City, Arizona, or the Midwest, what we'll say to you tonight is come on back with us, because this is informative. This is educational. But most importantly, it is critical that we talk, that we come up with answers and solutions to bring about change in this country. Ladies and gentlemen, this is AJC Radio. We're coming right back. We are in search for what everybody's in search for, and that is justice. Stand by. We'll be right back.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's time to stop, look, listen, and feel.
At the inception of A Just Cause Coast to Coast, the host and crew decided to devote a segment of each show to an exoneree moment. The purpose of the exoneree moment was to outline the case and highlight the circumstances that led to a wrongful conviction. AJC Radio also wanted to highlight the successes and failures of the justice system, understanding why the system failed and what ultimately turned the tide and cleared their name. We wanted to hear the personal first-hand accounts. They were appalling, emotional, astounding, and overwhelming. Lives devastated by the system. Most of the people who shared their stories were released from the building, but not from the system. They struggled to get their records expunged and clear their names, find suitable employment and housing, obtain restitution from the state, and reconnect with their families and friends. And it hardly fit the definition of exonerated, which means to free from guilt of blame, to clear from a charge of guilt or fault, to exculpate. These are the stories of lives taken and returned, but must be rebuilt, adapted, reestablished, and transformed. The profile of a wrongly convicted.
Today's profile features Michael Waith. On January 5, 1985, 39-year-old Dolores Taylor called police to report that three men tried to burglarize her apartment in Brooklyn, New York. She identified one of these three as 22-year-old Michael Waith, a man she suspected had stolen her car several months earlier. Waith was arrested and charged with burglary. He went on trial in Kings County Supreme Court in January 1987. There was no physical evidence or forensic evidence linking Waith to the crime. The state's evidence rested primarily on the testimony of Taylor, who identified Waith, a resident of the building she lived in, as one of the burglars. Taylor told the jury she was awakened at 4:30 a.m. by a loud crash, and from her foyer she saw the figure of a man in a darkened living room. She said she screamed, "What do you want?" and turned on the light. The man ran toward the apartment door yelling. Taylor said she went into her kitchen, where the light was already on, and saw a second man carrying her television toward the window. When she yelled, this man turned and dropped the television and ran past her out of the apartment door. Taylor further testified that after Waith ran from the apartment, she observed a third man on the fire escape but could not see his face. Waith, a native of Barbados with no prior criminal record, testified in his own defense and denied committing the crime. His defense lawyer presented witnesses who testified that Waith was elsewhere at the time of the crime. Nonetheless, on January 8, 1987, Waith was convicted of burglary. He served 18 months in prison before he was released on parole in 1988. In 2011, Waith went back to Barbados to attend the wedding of his daughter. When he returned, he was stopped at John F. Kennedy Airport and detained because he was a resident alien with a felony conviction. The federal government instituted deportation proceedings, and Waith was later released from detention. Waith's attorney, Matthew Smalls, requested that the Brooklyn District Attorney's Conviction Review Unit investigate the burglary case. An investigator located Taylor, the woman who said Waith was one of the burglars, living in Georgia. Taylor, who was 69 years old, admitted that there was no burglary and that she had falsely accused Waith. She said she was angry at him because she thought he had stolen her car months earlier. Appeared in Kings County Superior Court and filed a motion to have Waith's conviction vacated. The motion was granted and Thompson dismissed the charge. "I think Mr. Waith has already suffered enough for a crime he didn't commit," Thompson said. "Mr. Waith is a victim of a wrongful conviction. I won't let him be a victim of a wrongful deportation." The opinions and views expressed by guests and callers on A Just Cause Coast to Coast do not necessarily reflect those of A Just Cause or A Just Cause Coast to Coast.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is AJC Radio. I'm telling you, we're on a roll right now. The information that is needed in this country right now. And we've had the privilege tonight to have Shelley Broderick and Tamara Brown. And they have been a delight and a pleasure as we dig into protesting and the purpose of that in our country right now. The need for it, and they're doing some great things down there in D.C., and I'm telling you, a lot of people can take note and learn from these classy ladies tonight on what we're doing to try to bring about change, and we are fascinated tonight with what we've heard, and I'm telling you, it is thought-provoking, Cliff and Lisa, as we have been around the dinner table, as this they call this dinner table talk. We're not in front of a roast beef or baked chicken and broccoli and all that good stuff that folks enjoy across this country, but this is dinner. This is around the dinner table conversation. And Tamara and Shelley, we are very pleased to have you here tonight. And I tell you what, we've just been brought to our attention. I don't know if you folks, and we're going to ask you folks to chime in on this, about the information coming out of Wisconsin tonight. That the young man that was shot, the unarmed man that was shot, the officer will not face charges in that killing of that young man. And I'll tell you this, which is tragic to me. Dade County District Attorney Ismail Ozan makes the statement, "I conclude that the tragic and unfortunate death was the result of a lawful use of deadly police force, and that no charges should be brought against Officer Kenny in the death of Tony Robertson Jr." And that is how that was able to be formed in his mouth or on his lips is amazing to me. And they got pictures and things here of the folks have already taken to the streets as we embark upon this conversation tonight about protesting and getting in the mind of protesters. And people are looking, and the first sign that I'm seeing on this printout, it says "Justice for Tony," and I think again, Cliff, we said tonight and all along tonight, folks are in search for justice here.
Yeah, and what really gets you about this, I mean, you have the DAs basically saying, okay, there's going to be no charges. But then when they give the account of the police officer that, okay, this kid hit the police officer, knocked him into a wall. They said that account, an account the prosecutor said was supported by damage to the drywall. Okay, so he pushed you into a wall. Drywall is not that thick. Then they say, after that, Kenny, who was the officer, said he was afraid Robinson would hit him again or take his gun and open fired as the 19-year-old continued to come at him. In 3 seconds, 7 shots were fired. Now, the reason I take issue with the DA and the decision that he came back with, and maybe it's just not him, the reason I'll say I take issue with the decision is because a police officer trained cannot say, because I thought you were going to hit me, I shot you 7 times. That if you think a person is going to punch you, that is not grounds for shooting them until they die.
Absolutely.
You say, I thought he was going to take my gun. How is your thinking that somebody was going to... Then every police officer can go out on the street and say, I saw a person, they looked me in the eye, I thought they were going to attack me, I thought they were going to take my gun, so I open fired, I dumped my clip, and I killed them like a rabid dog in the street because I thought they were going to take my gun. That is not a justification for killing a person. I'm sorry. I understand if an officer feels like you're coming at me with a weapon, you have to shoot him. I get that. But I thought you were going to try to take my gun. I don't get that justification.
Well,
right there makes no sense to me.
Well, and I'll tell you this, Shelley, I'm going to ask you and Tamara to chime in on this. Excuse me. Did I hear you correctly? He emptied 7 shots in 3 seconds?
7 shots in 3 seconds. So
there's a little something else going on here. If I'm emptying my clip in 3 seconds, 7 bullets, am I hearing that right?
Yeah, you're pumping that trigger.
That's unbelievable. Now, if I'm fearful of my life, that seems like a, in my opinion, 7 rounds in 3 seconds is a bit, you've snapped somewhere along the way here. Something happened here. Shelley,
so I'm going to play devil's advocate.
Let's do it.
Okay. So I was a defense attorney for a long time, right? So that's, I think, always how I think. Even when the police officer is the one being accused, okay?
Okay.
So we don't know, right? If you believe somebody is coming at you, you know, and what we don't know is any of the facts. Like, is this a great big huge guy and you're a little bitty guy? Is this a great big huge guy coming at you with his arms reaching for your gun? In which case, you don't shoot once. You're just like, I'm going to do everything I can to stop this guy, right? Think about if it was reversed, you know, and what the guy was saying when the cop did that.
Right.
You know, you'd be thinking about it a little bit differently, maybe. I don't know. And here's the thing. That's the thing that's so frustrating. We don't know. So what does this country do? We go out and we put cameras everywhere. Are we going to be able to see somewhere on some store camera? Like they did in the Boston Marathon, they had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pictures. And in that case, we're glad because they actually were able to comb through all those pictures interfering with our privacy and find the culprits.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I hate that. I absolutely hate that. Am I glad they found the guys who did the Boston Marathon bombing? I was there. Yeah, I sure am. But I hate that interference. How do we know, though? You know, how do we know what happened? And it's just... You know,
can I chime in here really quickly?
Sure.
Please do.
If you don't mind. Okay. And I'm just coming from a law student's perspective, okay? And we're taught elements of a crime. And
oh,
one
I
of
love
them
it.
Is self-defense. Okay?
That's my girl.
So where I want to take this is just from a basic level. And I see an element of a crime and there's self-defense. This officer has risen to a deadly level. If pushing someone against the wall will not kill you. If he felt he was reaching for his gun, why 7 shots? Why not shoot him in the leg? I think that would stop someone. So, again, coming back just to being a basic, going into my third year in law school where I was taught by, you know, the wonderful Judge Pryor, elements of a crime and self, you know, there has to be you've taken this to a deadly level at this point. So I just don't think there's two sides. I don't know how a prosecutor looks at the law and looks at the elements of the law. And I believe that's what Marilyn Mosby did here in Baltimore. You know, I think she just went to the elements of each crime and each crime that fits, as I would have to do on a fact pattern in a law, in an essay, and that's what it was. And that's not self-defense. You know, you've taken it to a deadly level. And this young man didn't have a weapon. So there's really no excuse for it. But so, I think what the prosecutor in this case is saying, well, what's going to happen? I mean, what's the worst that's going to happen?
Sure. And I'll chime in on this, Tamara and Shelley, that gets me. And this is the question, Cliff and Lisa, that we've been asking for the last several months of these issues that have come up in this country. You know, there are tasers that officers are given to defer a situation from escalating, if you will, to a point, as you said, Tamara, to a deadly level. I am still trying to figure out where in Michael Brown's murder, the officer makes the statement he didn't feel like putting his other gear on. So you leave the police station, the precinct, if you will, not in a position to avoid a tragedy, but actually setting yourself up to have one.
To ensure
that. So if you're walking around with a taser, why are the tasers given? It is to slow a defendant down. That is the purpose. Why are these things not being used?
And you know, Shelley, to your point with the cameras, I neither like the cameras everywhere, you know, the everything that intrudes into your privacy. It does catch guilty people. The part about it that gets me more than the privacy is that it always works to find the assailant, except when it's a police officer, except when it's somebody in law enforcement. Huh. When you have on video a law enforcement officer, the video doesn't matter, the witnesses doesn't matter, the dead assailant doesn't matter. It's, I felt threatened for my life, therefore I use deadly force. That is always their defense. And more times than not, they get off on. We saw it with Michael Brown. I mean, you have not only the 5 seconds before, you have the whole crowd of officers coming to not Michael Brown, but oh my God, what's the gentleman's name in New York that they choked to death?
Eric Garner.
They choke him to death. You have like a full minute of video before the choking starts. The officer he resisted arrest. How are you resisting arrest with your hands out to the side saying, I cannot breathe? It works for everybody except law enforcement.
Absolutely.
You say the officer that ran, that was Michael Brown, right, that ran him down and says, the part that wasn't on the video, even though you saw my dash cam, you saw him take off running, the 5 seconds that you saw me that wasn't recorded, in North Carolina, in South Carolina,
Walter Scott.
The part that you saw that was not recorded is where I feared for my life. He tried to take my taser. He tried to reach for my gun. So when he ran and fled, that's when I shot him in the back until he fell, because I thought he was going to turn around and take my gun. That is the part that gets me, is that the cameras work for every defendant that says, well, hey, you know, the Boston Bombers, and I am not for anybody bombing anything. The Boston Marathon Bombers, it caught them. That's great. Every other piece of law enforcement, they say, here is the evidence. We have video footage. This is proof that this person did that. When you have proof that the cops broke the law, they took a life without cause, it never works on police officers.
And to that point, Shelley, did you want to say something?
Well, I was just going to say, I got to tell you, I was at a wedding at the Supreme Court performed by Sonia Sotomayor on a young woman who lived with me when she went to Howard and who has become an MPD, Metropolitan Police Department, police officer here in town. She married a Supreme Court police officer. I was at that wedding when the news came out that Marilyn Mosby was bringing those charges against six police officers. And my jaw is still on the ground. Because it was so unexpected. I can't believe it. Because you're right. We never seem to get the charges brought. Now, we'll see what happens with the charges. And I believe in innocent until proven guilty. Mm-hmm. I don't care who's, you know, held up. But I'm so thrilled that the charges were brought because the evidence warranted bringing the charges. Now we'll see. We'll probe that evidence. You know, we'll explore. Everybody will have the right to counsel. And we will really get into it. And that's the way it's supposed to happen, and it's just so rare. So this is another very disappointing one in Wisconsin because, you know, if you bring the charges, you're setting up a situation where you get a chance to allow the search for justice to happen.
Exactly. And you also, you keep the temperature of your community to a place where now the community can believe, okay, at least they hear, they understand that our lives matter too. To just say there was no crime committed, why won't you say, you know what, let's put this before a jury. Let's let the prosecutor and let the defense battle it out and say, was there a crime committed? Because,
or at least take it to the grand jury. Bringing the charges, there's plenty more steps. Take it to preliminary hearing. You know, let's just use the judicial process for what it's for.
But I think what becomes even more frustrating for the citizens, and I'm speaking for Baltimore City, is that charges are brought against citizens for a lot less evidence.
And
the citizens sit in jail. I know that the system is so slow in Baltimore. You can be innocent. You're innocent until proven guilty, but you're going to sit in jail for about a year if you can't get bail, at least. And that's the problem. It's a double standard. And again, I'm going back to law school. Nowhere in law school do I see, am I taught, well, these are different charges for police officers, or this is how you look at it. You know, for the police officer. I don't see that anywhere. It's a crime is a crime, and just because you put on a uniform, you still need to be held accountable. So there's frustration in the communities when your cousin is arrested because this person down the street said they did something, and that's all you need.
Right.
When you see something occur on camera and nothing happens. It's frustrating.
I couldn't agree more, but were you stunned? Having said that, were you stunned when 80 protesters were let out of jail the next day in Baltimore? I was. I figured they'd be locked up a lot longer.
But they reached their time limit, and they had to release them. Yeah.
But you know, there had been an agreement they could hold them longer, and they really didn't hold them much longer.
Right.
I thought that was going to be dragged out forever, and I was just so delighted. Some of our students worked on some of the legal research on the habeas petitions to spring those 80 people who did nothing more than exercise their First Amendment rights.
Well, I'll tell you this. I didn't mean to interrupt you, Shelley, but I'll tell you this right now. The thought that people are, and I'm going to tell you why the what's in the mind maybe of protesters, and this is my thought from someone who has experienced a wrongful conviction. I was wrongfully convicted in this state, the state of Colorado, for a crime I did not commit. Did 7 years in the state penitentiary here, and recently have been totally exonerated, completely, of those charges. But I'll tell you this right now: the thought that a man or a woman is innocent until proven guilty, that left town a couple of buses ago. That's no longer part of the route anymore, to be honest with you. Now, it takes nothing from the legal, as a law student.
Theory.
This is what it should be. But I'm telling you from personal experience, you are guilty until you in some way must prove that you did not commit a crime. 7 years taught me I'm guilty to proven innocent. And 7 years later, I'm free. But that's going a little bit backwards according to what this system is supposed to be.
Only if you're a cop, then you're guilty until they don't bring charges. I mean, you're innocent until they don't bring charges. And just you're off. That is what kills me.
Well, I can tell you one thing that happened, Shelley and Tamara, is that, at least in Cliff, nobody paid any bills for me when I was locked up.
Yeah, didn't spring you.
You got the police chief saying, we're going to, down there in Ferguson, I believe it was, said, we're going to continue to pay the officers' bills. His wife is pregnant. No, that's in North Carolina.
Yeah.
They said, you're going to still get your medical benefits. Now, if I was going to get benefits, I would have to eat that horrible, horrific green bologna and green hot dogs in county jail.
Well, first of all, can I just say how horribly sorry I am that you experienced that? That's just, I can't even imagine a worse nightmare than to sit in jail under any circumstances, but of course, particularly if you're innocent. I'm just so sorry that our system let you down that way.
No, and I appreciate that, and I was thinking about Cliff's point that he made earlier. Let's just, and Shelley, I'm going to use your phrase for a moment. Let's turn the table for a moment.
Okay.
Hypothetically, let's say a cop is shot and killed.
It happens.
So let's just say that hits the news. I can guarantee you, before you take your next swallow of coffee, that man is being locked up in an orange jumpsuit and handcuffed and chained. I'm telling you immediately, there is no way.
You see, they just got those two guys in Hattiesburg who shot the cop. Or those four guys who shot the cops.
Wow.
Yeah, they found them
quickly.
It was a matter of hours. And there were charges brought. The thing that really gets you.
All right, Shelley, Tamara, hold the line. We got a caller calling in. Cliff?
Yes, we have a caller, Marlene. You're on the air. Go ahead. You have a question or comment?
Yeah, I was trying to be quiet. You was talking about innocent to proven guilty.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't hold true for blacks. So. And my son, he's serving a 15 sentence of a wrongful conviction, and identification didn't match. There's no fingerprints. That's his. DNA is not his, but yet he's still rotting in prison. My grandson is probably needing counseling. Now he's 8 years old, wanting his dad is. It's just, it's like no hope and no one to turn to. You know, you waste all your money with these attorneys. They take your money and it's like they do nothing in court. Like they sell you out. It's just, your hands are totally tied. It's unbelievable.
Absolutely. And Marlene, we appreciate that comment. And so many times we found that to be true that, you know, like I said before, the innocent until proven guilty. Ma said, you know, it took the bus out of town a long time ago. And my point is that why is the citizen, like you said, Tamara, why is the common everyday citizen not given the same courtesy as law enforcement? That is what starts the riots. That's what starts not just the protests. The protests are okay, but the riot with the, you know, the just the anger and the frustration of how is it that not even a true charge, but just you're being accused of something by your neighbor. We're going to bring you in, we're going to charge you, and we're going to let the DA decide if you're guilty or not. When it comes to a police officer, sure, we got video, sure, we have witnesses, but we're not going to even charge you. You know, we're going to let you, you know, basically go home on paid leave for 6 weeks. We're going to do our own investigation to see if you should be charged. We have it on video. We have 25 witnesses that says you bashed a man's head into the curb. You broke his neck, and we cannot even get a charge. That is the type of thing that brings this level of frustration. That is the type of thing that causes the community, the whole frustration to boil over and say, that's why I throw a brick at the police officers. If we can get some type of balance, we pretty much stay that type of activity, I believe, in my opinion.
And Shelley and Tamara, I mean, we echo what you folks are doing down there in D.C. Shelley, Tamara, I cannot tell you how fortunate we were tonight to have you on this program. You have opened our eyes to a lot of things. I'm sure people across America, as we get ready to wrap up this program, we're going to take a quick break, but we'd like to give you an opportunity and thank you folks for joining us. And Shelley, how can folks get a hold of you if they need to reach you down there in D.C.?
I am the Dean of the University of the District of Columbia, the Public Law School for the District of Columbia. So Google, look us up, call me at 202-274-7332. I'm sbroderick@udc.edu. If you want to learn about social justice, if you want to be a lawyer in the movement, we got a law school for you that's affordable. It's $11,000 for a D.C. resident, $22,000 for out of state. You can become a D.C. resident in a year, and you can stay in D.C. and build our tax base and bring the movement and keep it at home.
All right. And Tamara, give your information. How can folks reach you? Are you reachable? Because I think you got a lot.
Yes, thank you. It's Tamara Brown. My email address is TamaraYBrown@yahoo.com.
Okay, folks, ladies and gentlemen of America, we have found a couple of heroes in our nation's capital that are making a difference in the lives of young people. And Shelley and Tamara, thank you so much for joining us. And as we fight for justice at AJC Radio and at A Just Cause, that's what we're about. And I think if we work together, as we have done tonight, to inform the American people what's going on, I think we're going to see change come. You folks have a very safe evening. Thanks for hanging out with us for this Tuesday evening. We thoroughly appreciate it, okay?
Thank you so much for having us. It was a pleasure, and you guys keep on doing what you're doing. It's so important.
We're going to do that, and Shelley, I'm going to be in touch with you about a couple of items that I think you can put some stuff to that I think is educational for us. I'll be in touch with you as well, and our team.
Look forward to it.
Right. Okay?
Thank you.
Ladies
Take
and gentlemen.
Care. And thank you, Tamara. You are the best.
Thanks, Dean Broderick. Take care.
Okay. You guys take care.
Bye-bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, Cliff and Lisa, and I tell you what, we're at a crossroad of decision. And that decision is, do we seek justice or do we just go back in the house and shut the front door? Well, I got news for you, AJC Radio, and A Just Cause. We're not going to do that, and we're not going to stop, but we're going to make a difference, and we need you to make that difference. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll be right back. This is AJC Radio. I'm Lamont Banks along with Cliff Stewart and Lisa Stewart, and we are in search for justice. Stand by. We'll be right back.
Government targeted, prosecuted, convicted, six executives in, held back evidence.
Come on,
hundreds of pages of Mr. Manuscript, court circuit, 10th district denying the writ of mandamus. Free the RP6, critical rights violations, scandalous. Their motivation is finished, they finished with major companies, the government, New York PD, BBS, potential customers.
Come on,
faith potential to obtain funding from banks and angel investors with no success. That calm mail down, finance skeptics, so they hire staff and come to fill the gap with every attention. To fulfill the contract, to the deal, when money come back, everybody paid the bills, the wages, take care of all of that. No Friday, they got viable software, but you compare them to those with nothing to offer. Prosecuted by the attorney's office before the FBI gotta start investigating charges, skipping steps in the process, even barring the testimony of Andrew Alvarez, a witness who could tell why any staffing company that could do a dumb rash street credit check would stick out their neck if there was no prospect they could collect. When they're reeling the net, it all relates to Harvey Silver's late statements about the vagueness of federal law, judicial chaos, A_JustCause. Read at RP6.org, 347-205-9620, Just Blog. It's just us, but we don't gotta just talk. We can just march through the courts for the cause with one voice. It's just free them all.
Come on.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have reached AJC Radio. And ladies and gentlemen, this has been a night I would call a night of very informative information, information that is a call to action, that we as American people begin to get in the fight against injustice. And, as I have been thrilled tonight with Shelley and Tamara and their information and the things that they had to say, Cliff, Lisa, what do you say when people are appearing, and from what I get from those ladies, that are trying in the midst of a hostile situation down there in Baltimore, that it was people dying all across this country, they are still committed to the fight that we are fighting, and that is the fight for justice. What are your thoughts on those two ladies? Cliff?
I think what they're doing is incredible, because they not only bring a legal perspective just from a profession, but they bring it to the community, and that's sure. The important part. We always say here on AJC Radio that we have to, the public has to get involved.
Sure.
And the public has to understand their rights. They have to be able to repeat their rights back to law enforcement, and they have to be able to exercise their rights. So they're doing all of that. They're saying, hey, go out there and protest, but do it properly, and understand if a law enforcement officer comes to you and tries to move you along and tries to put his hands on you improperly, that you have the right to say, you know what, I don't consent to this search on my person. Right now, you basically are illegally seizing me and illegally searching me. You can be brought up on charges. If a person understands that when they're doing a protest,
sure,
then the only thing that an officer can do is understand that, hey, this person knows the law. If I don't back down, I'm going to end up in trouble, and I'm going to end up with my whole department, basically in hot water. So I need to give you your 3 feet of space. What they're doing is saying, understand your rights and exercise those rights, but also give law enforcement officers their space. When you're doing wrong, expect for the law to come after you. But if you're doing right, do not accept for the law to mistreat you. I think that is the message that they're bringing to their community.
Well, and I think that's a good point. I think as we look at, and again, the pattern of abuse is what I call it across this country by officers.
Right.
Is not about, listen to the officer and you'll be okay. Listen to the officer, you may get a bullet in the back of your head.
Well, it's a warning
shot. Listen to the officer, you may be beat up unrecognizably with a bully club. This is the problem. The culture is the problem, and that is where we are right now. And, I'm sitting here. Lisa, I'd like to ask your thoughts. Shelley was going into, not Shelley, but Tamara as a mother.
dealing with telling her son. I believe you posed the question to her. At least, what challenges, as we see these things, what challenges do you face as a mother with a 14-year-old? Tell them that, you know what, your uncles are locked up, the RP6, I'll reference them now, and you know what, this is what he grew up seeing. How do you deal with those challenges?
Well, I think he's learning that our system is not what it's supposed to be. I think he's learning that doing the right thing does not always bring you justice. He's had to learn that the hard way.
Sure.
That you can do everything that's right, you can abide by the law, and do everything that you've been taught that's correct, and still end up with this kind of injustice in your life. And so
sure.
I think it's been difficult for him, but he's learning that. And what I do try to teach him is that you still want to abide by the law. You still want to do everything that you've been taught. That doesn't change.
Sure.
But the bottom line is, be aware that things are not always going to work out the way they're supposed to because you've done what's right.
And I think the point to that, Lisa, dig into that, you know, and as we get ready to wrap up another exciting AJC program tonight, Lisa, I think what's important, I think the tragedy of what you just said, we're not talking about someone who's 80 years old that's maybe on the way out and they've lived a productive life. We're talking about a young boy, the next generation, the future of this country. These are what our young people, your grandchildren, are looking at right now. A justice system that has failed and continues to fail. How do we then promote those youngsters to believe that change can come? What are we setting them up for? Ladies and gentlemen of America, if you think this is just about you, we got news for you. It's for little Johnny that just you tucked in tonight in his all pajamas and Superman bed and Batman clothes. It's little Susie who has the Barbie dolls in the corner of her room that she has a tea party with on a daily basis. This is our future here. Something has to be done and change has to come. America, this is our children. What are we going to do about it? What are you going to do about it? Cliff?
Yeah, I mean, you pose those questions. It's a difficult answer. I mean, education is part the basically your actions. But I think the biggest issue is when you look at situations like these young kids getting killed. You look at what's going on in Madison tonight. With the officer not being charged because I thought he was going to take my gun. That
yep.
is, it's sickening. But then, what do we tell the children on how to deal with law enforcement? Like Shelley was saying, you know, don't run. But when the officers pull out their gun, then what do you do?
Well, we're here, ladies and gentlemen. We are going to wrap things up here. Cliff, well spoken, well said. Lisa, This is a family fight, and we got to get in the fight and make it happen. So let's go ahead and thank our listeners for joining in tonight. We want you to send your prayers up for the RP6. David Banks, Dave Zappolo, Kendrick Barnes, Clint Stewart, Demetrius Harper, and Gary Walker, six men who have suffered and become victims of a system that has failed. And we ask that you hold them up in prayer. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. And go to freetherp6.org if you want to learn more about the RP6 and these six extraordinary men who have suffered a huge miscarriage of justice.
We also want to ask you, everyone who's listening, if you have the ability, go out to GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. And do a search on IRP6, and you will find a place where you can donate directly to the families of the IRP6. After the head of households and the breadwinners of these families have been taken away and wrongfully imprisoned, these families are in dire need of our support. They need your help. Anything that you can do is appreciated. We want everyone who has the ability to do it, go out there and do something. Everyone can't do the same thing, but everybody can do something.
Cliff? Yeah, I want to say thank you to our team, our production support team. We got Captain Kyle and Dustin Jackson of K&D Productions. They're helping out Ill Skills Girl to make sure that you hear what it is that we have to say every time we are on the air. Also, to our production support team, we
are gaining more and more members, and they're happy to be here to help. They ensure that we have accurate and up-to-date information so that we can deliver that to you on a nightly basis. And we thank you for To The Truth. We haven't forgot about you. We know you're out there. We appreciate it.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, this is AJC Radio, and you've reached a network that is doing things, and we are about making change. We ask you to join us on Thursday. We'll be back here from 6 p.m., 8 p.m. Eastern Time to 10 p.m. Eastern Time on Thursday. Join us. Call your friends. Talk about it. Tell everybody what we're doing down here, because this is what makes the difference. We want to thank Shelley and Tamara for joining us tonight and doing what we need to do. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you for AJC Radio. Cliff, you have something?
Yeah, also, you know, I don't want to leave out the people in the chat room. You guys had some very provocative, thought-inducing conversation that went on tonight. We thank you for all your input there. To our callers, you know, we appreciate your comments and questions. Feel free to always give us a call. We appreciate that as well. You know, don't be shy. When you're out there, you know, chime in. We love to hear from you.
Ladies and gentlemen, that is the sound of war. Get your boots on. Get your hat on. It's time to go to battle. And what is that battle for, ladies and gentlemen? It's for what we call justice. This is AJC Radio. I'm Lamont Banks for Lisa Stewart, Cliff Stewart, and all of the AJC family. Have a good night. Take care of each other as we search for justice. Good night.
Good night.
Is a threat to justice everywhere.